Hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast, your weekly dose of inspiration and exploration. Join me, your host, Sam Harris, as I discover how mindset can help you do incredible things through my conversations with the world's most interesting people, from tech billionaires to leading scientists, best-selling authors to notorious hackers. The goal is to increase our collective wisdom and attitudes to make us all happier and healthier, wiser and wealthier. Who doesn't want that? I am delighted to bring to you my conversation with Dr. Niall McCann. He is an adventuring explorer who, amongst other things, has rowed across the Atlantic, cycled the Himalayas, and skied across Greenland. When he isn't off exploring, he's off saving the world's natural beauty, the species, and environment as a conservationist. And no, he's not a smelly hippie tying himself to trees who, actually, they're pretty awesome people. I don't want to put them down at all. But anyway, he's not one of those people. He is the Director of Conservation for National Park Rescue. Scientific investigations of the destruction of the habitats and poaching is used to lobby policymakers and actually make it stop at a fundamental level. And because of his work, it's resulted in the protection of several national parks across Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And because of this, there's huge areas of rainforest and wildlife that exist today because of his efforts. His work and adventures have resulted in a career in TV, with various documentaries being made on the amazing things that he does. He lives in Wales, and when he isn't somewhere exotic, he's also still being a hero because he worked for the mountain rescue team saving lives in the local areas. So to summarise, he is a bit of a dude, to say the least. It was amazing to talk to someone who is exploring the limits of his own boundaries and capabilities, who is just making the most of experiencing and cherishing the amazing world that we live in, whilst also doing a bloody fantastic job of protecting it. It's amazing to actually find out how the hell you can go about doing all these incredible things, and I just hope that you pick up some of the huge life and mindset lessons that we discuss. And now, without further ado, I bring to you Dr. Niall McCann and our conversation about conversation. Wait, I got that wrong, didn't I? It's a conversation about conservation. Good. Nice one, Sam. Anyway, awesome stuff is about to hit your ears, so enjoy.
From a very young age, I knew that I wanted to be a biologist and to work in the natural world. I also wanted to have adventures kind of focused on the natural world in some way. So be that through wildlife or through exploration to places that are really spectacular geographically, geologically, or whatever it was. So from a very early age, I started to push my career down the line of being a biologist. And I always thought that I'd probably end up in research, studying animals in funny parts of the world, and maybe getting involved in some conservation. But then as time went by, I realized that actually my focus really shouldn't be just on research and on wildlife biology. It needed to be on conservation, because it seemed futile for me to be researching conservation, which is basically just chalking off every time another species goes extinct, or, oh, there's another dead animal, that seems great, okay, tick, add that onto my graph. And that just seemed like an element of futility. And I wasn't very good at graphs, so it also didn't seem that I was the best person to be doing that. That's a really important task, that people are recording what's happening to wildlife. I'm just not the best man for it. What I realized that I needed to do to fulfill my own potential, to keep myself interested, to make sure that I was getting the most out of my life, was to try and stop that killing happening in the first place. So I started to get interested in the protection of wildlife, the protection of national parks and of other areas of land where wildlife lives. And I got into setting up national park protection services, I suppose. So that started in Latin America, and then I've done lots of ranger training in various other places like India and different parts of Africa. And then 3 years ago, I set up an organization called National Park Rescue with the idea of identifying national parks that cannot cope with the poaching crisis and then trying to rescue them. And we've been operating in Zimbabwe for 18 months. Before that, we were in Malawi. And we have a very comprehensive model to try and protect national parks that are basically on the brink of being de-gazetted. And it brings me immense personal satisfaction. I know we're having a huge impact globally, which is brilliant. I'm lucky enough to meet lots of interesting people through it. But then, in addition to that, I don't want to be just all work, no play. So I've also maintained quite an active extracurricular life with lots of expeditions and adventures all over the world, lots of different types of modes of transport. So mountaineering, rock climbing, cycling, canoeing, skiing, rowing, lots of different things just to keep challenging myself and keep experiencing new things and seeing new places. And then I suppose the third major aspect of my professional life is a professional adventurer in a way, professional conservationist, and then professional within the television industry as well. So for the last 9 years, I've been lucky enough to present and or narrate scientific programming. So principally it's wildlife documentaries, but then I've also done a few non-wildlife science documentaries as well, where I've been the narrator or the presenter. And that's been immense fun as well. Kind of like biology, I don't feel there's enough in there for me to only do that. It would feel as though it was a bit frivolous. Biology isn't frivolous, but research for research's sake is not the best way to use my own life. Television is frivolous. And if I was just spending my life being a telly lovey, I would not be doing enough with my life. But it's a great addition to everything I'm doing. And because I work in conservation television, I also have the opportunity to stand on a soapbox and talk to a massive audience that I could never reach any other way about conservation issues, which is a great, great privilege.
Yeah, cool. Thanks for the summary. It's really handy just to kind of get an overview of all the things you've been doing. So lots of interesting stuff to kind of go into, I guess. Starting on like the first strand of the conservation, was it quite easy to go from just being a guide doing the data side to actually going out and implementing things? Or did you have to learn a lot of stuff and take on some challenges to be able to go and do things? Like, how did you get into the process of actually action?
It's never easy, any of these things. I think you talked about this when we met, that these little summaries that we give in a few minutes are a glimpse into many, many years of hard work that's got you to anywhere. So you can give a 5-minute talk about your life, but that's 18 years that I've just described to you there in about 4 or 5 minutes, and all the way along that's been a hard graft. So as a field biologist, what gave me an advantage for getting into that wildlife protection and that ranger training aspect was that I was quite a remote field biologist. So I used to do expeditions to go do research in places that were very far away, so lugging big weights and going to interesting parts and having to track animals and then track other things and setting up remote camera traps and all that type of stuff. So I understood what it took to operate in really difficult environments where you're tracking. And National Park Protection is essentially tracking, normally people, but wildlife as well, in really difficult environments. The thing that really makes a difference, though, in my case, because I'm more senior in the organization, is that I have to be able to negotiate. You have to be quite diplomatic. And we've got people that just act as trainers for us, and they're fantastic. And they understand tracking far better than I ever could. And they know how to train the rangers in all of the aspects of protecting a national park. But they might not be best deployed into a government office to try and convince a foreign government to commit certain resources to an area or to stop a building project happening or whatever it is. And that's where I was able to, I suppose, develop those skills from just enjoying socializing and enjoying talking to people to then taking that into the boardrooms and then into government offices and convincing governments to make a difference when it comes to environmental planning in their own countries. And that's the difficult thing, I suppose. I suppose almost anyone could ostensibly learn how to train rangers, how to navigate, or how to do first aid, or how to shoot their guns in the right direction. But actually being able to negotiate for the protection of places that have many, many conflicting interests takes a bit more natural intuition and a bit of skill, potentially.
Yeah. How did you realize that that was like one of the problems that you needed to solve?
When I was doing my PhD in Honduras, I was there for 4 years in a row. And over those 4 years, the forest that I was doing a lot of work in just got smaller and smaller, and the animals in there were progressively killed, and we realized that nothing was happening. And I'd spoken to various people that work in conservation, very much in inverted commas, and they said that they'd been trying. So they'd spoken to the local government department about trying to stop all this happening, but nothing had really happened. And I realized that people that work in conservation don't really work in conservation because they're not conserving anything. They can say they're conservationists, but you're not really a conservationist unless you've conserved something, stopped something being killed, stopped something being chopped down. And the disconnect was that people didn't aim high enough up the ladder. They were going and speaking to an intern or whoever it was at the local environment agency. Whereas what you really need to do is you need to call up the Minister for Environment and go and sit in his office and tell him what's happening. And when it comes to Honduras, that's exactly what I did. I realized that after 4 years of watching other people fail, what I needed to do was get away into the Minister for Environment's office. And so I sat with him. It's the first time I'd ever presented in Spanish. I presented what was going on in this national park, all the things that was happening to the forest and the wildlife, and the fact that I'd found some drugs growing in there, which definitely interested him. And I said, we need to sort this out. And while I was in the meeting with him, he got on the phone to the Minister for Defense, and we sorted it out then and there. And that's what it took. And so it was like a light bulb moment. Like, right, okay, well, you can either faff around, chatting to the interns, trying to get them excited about something, or you can go and speak to the minister and have something happen instantly. And that's what I've done ever since. So Zimbabwe just goes straight into the embassy and gets things started there. They then provide you an introduction to the ministers. Go meet the ministers. Great, done. Same with Malawi and all of these other things. If you're aiming high enough, you can make a much bigger difference. And what most people don't realize is that you can aim that high.
That's really funny. I found similar things myself with like my podcast. If I try and speak to someone who like works for a company, like, oh, I'd love to talk to CEO. They were like, oh yeah, sure, I'll try. And like, they didn't get anywhere. If I just like meet someone and go like, oh cool, you run this amazing huge business, would you be on the podcast? I'm like, yeah mate, it'd be amazing. And like, I love it. And if you just go straight towards the person you want to talk to, it's just so much more effective. And same with my first business as well. And things like, also when you're trying to get grants and stuff, sort of just kind of going through the whole process, if you just talk to the person running it and see if like the grant's for you or whatever, It's just like, it'll save so much time actually like building an application that they want to actually have.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm in the process of developing a relationship with the British government when it comes to at my organization. And the way you do that, the way that works is that they become a grant giving organization to you. The government gives you grants, but they've got hundreds of organizations that are applying for them for grants. So I've just got to know the people that write them. And that just, it's just so much simpler. So I was on the phone earlier today with a guy from the Department for International Development who gives out the grants. And that's the way to do it. So you need to know what buttons to push. So in our case in Honduras, I knew that the guy was quite interested in his legacy, and he didn't want his legacy to be that this national park had been taken over by drugs criminals. So when I explained that, oh yeah, right, I found all this marijuana there, he's like, hey, need to stop that, get straight on the case. It's finding what buttons it is to push. We managed to save an area of a river in Guyana. 2009, got a whole load of gold mining claims revoked by presidential decree because we found out that the ambassador's wife was hugely into conservation. So we got through to her. She knew the former head of the military who was massively into conservation, and she gave him our report by hand. He read it and took it to the president. And then overnight, all those gold mining claims were revoked by presidential decree because the guy that liked our report took it to him directly. So it's about cutting out the middleman, finding who it is that's going to be able to do that for you.
That's awesome. Cool. Okay, so on the side of protection, you've spoken mainly about like animals and things. Are you also concerned about things like palm oil and just general description of like wide areas of habitat, or is it more the conservation of species that's you find easier to implement?
Conservation for species is probably easier to fundraise for because people get massively attached to elephants or to seals or to tigers or whatever it is, and you can use those as interest generating mechanisms, whereas no one's going to be so interested about a large swathe of land. Like even the palm oil situation, what people are really concerned about is the orangutans. They're not so concerned about the fact that those areas are now carbon sinks instead of being carbon sources, or the other way around, they're carbon sources instead of carbon sinks. Now palm oil is obviously a really complicated one because it's far more productive than any of the next most productive oil mechanisms. So if we still need to produce oil, then palm oil is by far the best we can use. It's very ironic.
Yeah, it's just where the land's been coming from. And if you didn't have like the beef farm, it takes up so much land elsewhere, then you wouldn't have need to be knocking down any rainforest.
Absolutely. Yeah. So of course, those types of things are a big concern for me. And with National Park Rescue, what we're looking at is trying to protect national parks. So large areas where there's loads of things inside there. But we well understand that the parks we go to protect need to have charismatic megafauna to interest people. So the park we're working in Zimbabwe at the moment used to have 300 black rhino, which was the highest population of black rhino anywhere in southern Africa, and they were all killed. All of them were killed in a five-year killing spree between 1989 and 1994. So we have the prospects, if we get this park to being sufficiently well-functioning again, to bring rhinos back. That's really attractive to people. It's also a really interesting conservation story, and it's the right thing to do. When it comes to the elephants that live there, there used to be 3,500, and in a 10-year killing spree, they're down to about 500. So they've lost about 3,000 elephants in 10 years, which is madness in one little place. So that's 6,000 tusks going onto the market because of the failure to protect one park. And what we've done in the 18 months that we've been there is we've turned that killing rate to zero. So not a single elephant has been killed on our watch. And that's the type of thing that we can generate revenue from in terms of donors, get them really fired up, because we've turned this place from a killing zone into a refuge once more. But really what we're doing is we're protecting this whole park. We're becoming the biggest employer for local people. We're generating tourism. We're protecting a whole swathe of animals and a large area of land, which is going to act as a carbon sink, et cetera, et cetera. So we're doing that landscape scale conservation. You're just using the charismatic megafauna as your mechanism for generating the funds.
Yeah, that's really cool. So yeah, it's a hard one to really sort of tell people why they should stop destroying rainforest and things if they can economically just have a big incentive from it. But then kind of like the studies of like places where they used to kill all like the turtles and things because the locals just wanted to eat them, and then if you sort of sell it to the locals, that actually they'll get more tourism and then be like way more rich and they can eat whatever the hell they want from anything if they kind of protect them, and suddenly you can change the whole island's philosophy.
Yeah, very much so. And trying to get people to understand the tragedy of the commons as well, that if you carry on all just trying to kill these as fast as you possibly can, one of you is going to eat the last turtle and then there will be none for any of you. And that's difficult to get people into that mentality of the tragedy of the commons. It's a mistake that's been made by every society throughout history, but it's critical that people remember that. And the difficulty is that most people aren't long-termism in their thinking. And certainly if you're hungry, it's very difficult to be long-termism. That turtle's going to look really attractive to you if you're hungry. So for us, a big part of what we're doing is to try and provide alternatives. So make people realize that their prosperity is linked to the prosperity of that park. And that's a difficult thing to do, but it's something we're really working on.
It's trying to not just tell people, but actually build the economic incentive into it, so it creates the jobs and things. It's fundamentally the way to change all behavior, really, rather than just telling people off. It doesn't really usually make that much difference. But if you can give them a huge incentive to do like the better thing, then it's sort of natural that they just go and do it.
Yeah, so within conservation, there's lots of organizations that got into conservation payments. So they provide a stipend for increases in the number of animals that are there. For us, what we're doing is we are the largest local employer and we buy food for the rangers from the communities. And we do that on a rotational basis. And if one community is involved in illegal activity for a while, we just reduce the dividend that they get from the park there by buying food off them at a lesser rate than we do from their surrounding communities. So you're intrinsically creating a functioning microeconomy between the park and the communities, that if we were to leave and the park were to go back to where it was again, those communities would no longer be able to sell any food to the rangers because there wouldn't be the money to do it. They would no longer be employed because we're not there anymore. So we're tying their livelihoods into the success of that park. Also, if all the animals are killed, there will be zero tourists. In 2017, there were under 100 tourists, which is insane. And that's because almost all the animals have been killed. The ones that hadn't been killed were terrified of people. So the second that any animal saw a person, it was just off. Or it saw a vehicle, it took off. And I first went to that national park in April 2017, and it took until August 2018 for me to first see an elephant in that park. And now I know that my staff who are there are seeing them almost every day, and they're seeing them from our camp. And that's just extraordinary. And there has not been time for the population to increase. It's just a behavioral change, because they're no longer being shot by every person that sees them. They've chilled out and they're coming back and they're easy to see. And if animals are easy to see, then tourists want to go there. And so it's all a positive feedback cycle. The more we put into there, the more the animals come back, the more people want to come in, the more money's in there, the more we can reinvest. And it all goes that way. Whereas what's been up until now has been a negative feedback cycle. And like the worse the park got, the less people wanted to go there, the more indebted the park got, the more incentivized the rangers were, therefore, to kill the animals and sell them out, et cetera, et cetera. So it just kept on spiraling out of control.
Cool. Yeah, well, the cool that you're now doing the positive feedback loop. That's really good to hear.
Yeah.
So is there anything else in the area that you think I should know about that I haven't asked when it comes to conservation things?
Well, goodness. One of the things that I think is really important to understand is that wildlife crime, which is the area that I'm really working in, is actually one of the largest forms of serious organized crime. We're talking revenues of upwards of $20 billion a year coming from legal wildlife trade. And the same gangs and the same people that are running guns and drugs and human beings across international borders are also running wildlife products. So rhino horn, elephant tusks, pangolin scales. It's these same serious organized criminals that are doing all of this activity. And the funds involved are massive. And it really is a new, relatively low risk way of criminals earning a huge amount of cash, which makes it very, very important because all of the countries that are losing these animals are losing out an enormous amount of their wealth. If you think of Kenya, Tanzania, Botswana, whatever, those animals are quite literally the assets of those countries. For Botswana, ecotourism is the second largest part of GDP after diamonds. So next to diamonds, the most important assets to that country are its wildlife. So it's elephants, it's wild dogs, it's lions, etc. And if those are being killed and sold to a Chinese end user, that country is being robbed in the same way as if the national treasury was having the gold or the diamonds stolen out of the treasury. And if a country's treasury was being robbed, you're goddamn right that they would protect that treasury. And so what these countries are realizing is that they need to start protecting their national parks in the same way as they would protect their banks, because national parks are the bank vaults of these countries that are being pilfered. And we need to stop that. These countries cannot earn a living. They cannot become sustainable unless those parks are protected. And that's what we're trying to do, is try and convince many of these governments of how much revenue they have in their inherent natural capital, which is currently being stolen. And then just in terms of the law enforcement side of things, if you've got the same gangs that are doing all of this illegal activity, if you can trace those gangs through their operations in illegal wildlife trade, you have the prospect of smashing the biggest criminal gangs that are also involved in drugs and guns and people trafficking. So it's a very important law enforcement perspective. It's very important in terms of developing nation prosperity. Also in terms of regional security as well. If you've got an area with active gangs that are hunting elephants, as happens in various places, large gangs of very, very well-armed people, that's hugely disrupting to the regional security. And so there's a regional security aspect to the protection of wildlife and protected areas as well, which the British government is starting to realise. Hence, DFID, DEFRA, and the MOD and the FCO are all starting to link biodiversity protection to their international diplomatic efforts. They realise it's not just important for carbon and for climate change, which it is. It's also important for regional stability, for reducing migrant numbers, for increasing the prosperity of developing nations, and all of these things. And the dots are slowly being joined. So what used to be seen as basically the preserve of a bunch of sandal and sock wearing biologists is now actually being seen becoming very much a part of every other major industry. We've got biologists that are involved. We've got law enforcement professionals that are involved. We've got financial services professionals that are involved. We've got tourism professionals that are involved. We've got social scientists and development professionals that are involved. The conservation world is enormous now, and it takes in skills and expertise from so many different areas, and it's no longer just men in pith helmets with a butterfly net as it used to be.
Yeah, it's really interesting just to see how the connected everything is,
and I've kind of just scratched the surface in 5 minutes again there. It's huge.
Have some of your documentaries sort of gone into this kind of thing?
Much less so, because almost inevitably television is about clickbait and ratings. So you met Sophie Lanfear, or would have seen her speak, who's just been involved in this Netflix documentary, Our Planet. And what they have done explicitly is said that they're going to be different. They're not going to just be about entertainment. They're going to entertain us with some of the best imagery you've ever seen, but they are going to push that conservation message and push the fact that there is no planet B. We're running out of space on this one. And I think that's really important. Television for years has avoided that. And the BBC have been very much complicit in avoiding conservation with a capital C. And finally, that's starting to change. And the programmes that I've been on, you could quite justifiably criticise for being a little bit too entertaining in the past and not having enough serious matter. And that's why I'm very pleased at the moment that the current series that I'm working on is explicitly about human-wildlife conflict. It runs under the subheading of sometimes the animals that we fear the most are the ones that need the most help. If you look at, I suppose, sharks are a great example that we haven't covered. People are intrinsically terrified of sharks, yet they are dropping off a cliff because of persecution. The animals that we've been covering on this series so far, we've looked at polar bears, which are massively threatened by climate change. And it's been really refreshing for me to be able to talk openly about climate change on television, because up until very recently, a lot of networks, and not just American networks, which you'd expect to be idiots when it comes to this type of thing, but lots of domestic networks as well, will not want climate change talked about openly because they don't want to offend their viewers, or they don't want to overly educate their viewers. They want just to purely entertain them. But I've been able to talk explicitly about climate change. I've just been in India doing a few shows, and one of them was about human-elephant conflicts, because 400 people are killed every year by elephants in India, and a lot of elephants die as a result of conflict with people as well. And that's because of land habitat loss. So agricultural practices that are completely unsustainable, and human population growth that has just gone through the roof, meaning there's basically no space for the 40,000 elephants that are left. And I've been delighted. I've been able to talk about that explicitly, about it is the human impact that is creating this crisis of elephants. So these conflicts we see where people are killed by elephants, and that's tragic, that's because of us when it comes down to it. The elephants want to be left alone. It's we have taken their land, and in many cases, we're chasing them out of the villages with burning pitchforks and trying to pull their tails and lob rocks at them. And surprisingly enough, they turn around and smash people every now and then.
Makes sense. It's very easy to like think of it from the human point of view, of like not think about the fact that we caused a much bigger problem in the first place.
Very much so. One of the fascinating things about India, though, is because a lot of animals are actually revered. So Ganesh is one of the most revered gods, and he's an elephant. And so elephants are actually looked at much more positively across the Indian subcontinent than they are in sub-Saharan Africa, where they're basically seen as a large version of a rat. That's some form of pest that's there just to eat my stuff and occasionally hurt my relatives. Whereas in India, because they're revered, that makes conservation a lot easier, because there's a natural understanding that these animals have a right to be here, in the same way as that just isn't that level of understanding across many parts of sub-Saharan Africa.
Interesting. Really think there's like a bit of a shift in what people are like interested to actually find out about and listen to. So it's kind of sad though that it's taken them so long to actually start airing these things.
Completely. I think it's a complete derogation of responsibility by the networks. They've always just chosen titillating things like Vet Next Door and all these just purely titillating programs where you learn nothing. You do not learn anything about a vet who makes dogs, like violent dogs, be much, much happier, really. Was that Caesar the Happy Vet, or whatever his name is? It's just...
That's awful.
It's on Animal Planet, and it's just crap. It's just crap. And really, people, I think the networks have neglected a huge part of the viewing populace that are intelligent and engaged, and they've swamped them with rubbish. Whereas people want to learn about what's happening to the world and they want to engage with it. As we're now seeing, our planet has had unbelievable viewing figures. And that's partially because people are engaged in what's going on in their world. And I think networks had a responsibility that they've put to one side. All they've seen is viewing numbers. But by doing that, they've also forgotten that there is a significant portion of people, a significant viewing populace, that wants to see intelligent programming. And it's been a nightmare for me going through this. So a number of times I've been asked to repeat a sentence but use fewer syllables when you're filming. Well, come on, I know my audience. I don't want my audience to be the type of people that only speak in two syllables. I would like my audience to be quite intelligent, because what I'm trying to talk about is something that requires an engagement. And even if the people do struggle with more than two syllables, I want them to learn about the world. And surely television should be about education as well. But that's kind of gone. And you can even look at that within Attenborough's career. You look at the programs that he was producing himself and writing himself back through the 70s and 80s and 90s. And each series, Trials of Life, Life on Earth, that was a degree in a show. Whereas these days, the ones that he narrates, he doesn't write, he narrates them. They're beautifully shot, but they're education deficient. You don't actually learn anything, really, apart from you see a photograph of the novel behavior. You're not learning about how the world works and how it's actually intertwined and the evolution of these things and what that means for the environment. Like, all of those bits are missing. It's beautiful sequence after beautiful sequence after beautiful sequence. And it's lovely, as they call it, sit back television. You sit back and you just watch it and you don't have to think. Whereas Attenborough before, when he was writing this, was teaching the world about the world. And I think that's what we need to go back to, that television should be there as an educational resource. It's an amazing resource for education. And the ball has been dropped for about three decades.
Mm. There's a few things I really enjoy, like Horizon and stuff. It's some great education, but that has probably been one of the issues why I maybe just didn't watch that much TV, because it was just so boring. But I think that's maybe one of the reasons why podcasts have grown so much, because of you can kind of find whatever you want, and there's plenty of intelligent people talking to other intelligent people about intelligent things, and you can kind of be like, oh, so much better than listening to just some drivel on the radio of some man talking about like what he had for breakfast yesterday. And you're like, why? Meaning of the stuff that people talk about on radio shows when there's so much interesting stuff to learn.
There's great stuff out there. You're right.
Yeah, I don't know if like TVs have kind of noticed the increased appetite for like that kind of content that's a bit more intellectually stimulating with things like podcasts and stuff. Or if it's just more niching of audiences, is there's just more and more programs in general?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And I don't know the answer, whether that's it, whether it's just a greater number of niches have evolved, or whether television executives have cottoned onto the fact that you can actually get good viewer ratings with intelligent programming. And the cynic in me suggests that that's actually what's happened, is that Discovery, Nat Geo, BBC, all of these guys that have been pumping out information negative programs for the last couple of decades have realized actually we can put some information in there and still get good ratings, which no matter what it is, I'm glad that it's happening. I just feel that, like they say about Boris Johnson, he waits to see which way the crowd's running and then he runs out in front of them and says follow me. Yeah. I feel that the television networks have been like that as well. They're waiting to see which way the tide is going, and then they're doing their programming as a result. I'm really critical about that, because I feel they should have a moral responsibility to provide good quality educational programming, but they don't. They feel that they should be entertaining what people want.
Mm.
Like with Paul Dacre, the guy that used to be the editor of the Daily Mail, people say about him, he knew what his audience wanted and he gave it to them. And some people said that was a compliment and others as an insult. And it's quite interesting. You could take it as either way. For me, I'd say that's a massive insult for him. But others would go, no, that guy, brilliant editor, because he knew exactly what they wanted and he gave it to them. And therefore, they bought more of it and more and more and more. It's interesting which way you look at it.
Yeah, definitely. I guess it's also a bit like, like with big corporates, to say how difficult it is for them to like change and innovate when you have like startups that come and sort of show the way, and then suddenly like they'll actually play catch up. I guess that suddenly with media, it's always been just controlled by the big people that don't want to change things. But then now with like podcasting or blogging, you can suddenly start just putting out content on YouTube straight away. And that's just sort of showing the way that people would like to be going more, and suddenly it's sort of built for them and they kind of have to catch up as a theory. Anyway, on the subject of TV still, as we're on it, how did you get into doing a TV for the first time?
I suppose I've been flirting with the TV industry since I was an undergrad, because I'd gone into the natural history units because I was at Bristol University, natural history units there. I'd gone in and I was off doing a couple of quite exciting adventures as a young man. So in the summer of my first year at university, I canoed the Yukon River, which was quite exciting. And then summer of my second year, I spent 7 weeks out in Bolivia studying giant otters, which was quite exciting. And all of these things as a young biology undergraduate were of interest to the natural history unit. So they sent me out to Bolivia with a sound recording kit so I could make some sound recordings of what I was doing with the hope of making a Radio 4 program, which never materialized. So for quite a few years from undergraduate onwards, I've been talking to television about the types of adventures I was having. So I was going on these interesting adventures all over the world, some of them related to biology, some of them completely unrelated to biology, but always doing things that were quite eye-catching. And inevitably, the press like that. They like the fact that a young lad is off doing something exciting in a different part of the world because it's not usual. And so I'd get pictures would appear in the paper and all this type of stuff. And television companies would always say, oh, we must make a program about this someday. And 100 television companies said that and nothing happened. And then finally one said it and it did. It was just a game of numbers. Like, the television industry is a funny old place. I was never pursuing it directly, but I was always entertaining phone calls from TV companies. And for everyone that said, oh, we must make this program, I knew it wasn't going to happen. And then finally one did. So I met these guys completely by random, by accident, at random, in Bristol, at a public talk. And a friend of mine was on the panel, so I'd gone along to see it. And I was chatting to him after this talk about an expedition I was about to do to southern Guyana, where there's anacondas and jaguars and harpy eagles and all these extraordinary things. And a lady walked past and overheard my conversation and grabbed me and said, we need to talk. And she happened to be one part of a duo, a production company, husband and wife production company based out of Canada called Griffin Productions. And 2 years later, we went out to Brazil and made a program about a British explorer for the History Channel and for PBS. From that completely random meeting of her overhearing a conversation I was having with a friend of mine in Bristol. This is pretty mad. Yeah, so they realized here I was as this young, I would have been 27 at the time, 27-year-old British biologist and young explorer, young adventurer. And they thought, well, that's relatively good material for television. And they formulated this program idea about Colonel Percy Fawcett, a British adventurer who gone missing in the mid-1920s in the Amazon, looking for the lost city of Zed. You might have heard of that. And because of my background in exploration and doing lots of stuff in South America, I seemed like a relatively sensible person to present it. And I did. And that went well, and it was very well received and won a couple of awards. And on the back of that, we got a series on human-wildlife conflicts type stuff, and sort of made 3 series of that, and then got involved in narrating for other things as well, just because once you're in the industry, you're then known, and it's snowballed from there. And it's been quite interesting because I've still never really actively pursued it. I've always had these other things happening. So I started my PhD, but then was doing this television as the side, but kept the PhD going. And then when I finished my PhD, kept on having television on the side, then set up National Park Rescue. And now National Park Rescue is my real focus, but it's nice to have TV happening as an aside. But I'm very strict with how much time I can spend away from my National Park Rescue work, because I can't spend 6 months of the year away, because then I wouldn't be doing what I really want to do. And it's quite funny, because a lot of television companies say, oh, we like you because you're authentic, you do this stuff for real. But then they offer you a job that demands you being away from your job for 6 months of the year, which means I can't do my job, so I'm no longer authentic. And they don't see the irony in that. So I turned down a big TV job last year because of that reason. They wanted me to be away for 6 months of the year. And I'm like, well, I can't take that much time away from work. And they're like, but TV is work. I'm like, well, it's not work for me. TV's kind of a fun little aside. My work is trying to stop people destroying the natural world. And I can't do that in television. I'd be wasting my time. I have a great amount of fun doing the television stuff, and I have this soapbox that I can talk about conservation and climate change and everything, which is brilliant. But whenever I've been making television of conservationists, I've always felt that I was in the wrong place. I always felt that I should be the guy that's there still trying to save these gorillas and not just taking some pictures of it for a week and then heading off. And that always felt strange to me. Turn up at a place where someone's working on lions or gorillas or crocodiles, whatever it is, and you film them for a week, 2 weeks, and then you leave. And I didn't want to leave. I wanted to stay. And so that's what's important for me. What grounds me is my conservation work, and the television is temporary.
That's interesting. And certainly one of the things for success in like TV or giving speech or anything is having a good story to tell. So I think like having all these experiences is much more important than just, yeah, being full-time someone talking about someone else's experiences kind of thing. And it's kind of how you get to have these opportunities in the first place.
Very much so. Yeah. So my television career was built upon the fact that I was doing expeditions and adventures anyway, and that was seen as attractive. So that level of authenticity, and then I've managed to mold that into a TV career as well. It's been really nice.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. Okay, and then I guess the last big thing was be to go into the expeditions that you've done, because they've sounded pretty awesome. When did you feel like you're an explorer? Like, how did that start exactly?
I always felt like a fraud. I think with so many things, lots of us, I'm sure you must have felt this at times as well, you get this sense of imposter syndrome. And I always felt that I was a little bit afraid of things and not really very tough. And so my early forays into expeditioning and adventuring were partially a personal challenge to try and prove to myself that I wasn't as afraid as I was worried I was, and that I was slightly tougher than I thought I was. And so my first big expedition was actually spending a month cycling over the Himalayas straight off my A-levels. So most of my friends flew off to Magaluf, and I flew to Kazakhstan, and then spent a month cycling. We landed in Kazakhstan, then mainly cycled from Bishkek in Kyrgyzstan through Kyrgyzstan down into Kashgar in western China, over the Karakoram Highway, and down into northern Pakistan. And I picked up my A-level results in an internet cafe in Gilgit in northern Pakistan, having got an email address for the first time a month before where I'd started the trip. I'd signed up my email address, my Hotmail address. And then, yeah, a month later, got my A-level results in northern Pakistan. I found, ooh, got into Bristol. That's nice. So that was my first big adventure. And from then, it was quite interesting. I think from that point, I felt, no, this is what I want to be doing. Even though I felt like I wasn't naturally necessarily so talented at any of these things, I wasn't a great cyclist or canoeist or skier or rower or mountaineer or climber. I'm not brilliant at any of those things. I just felt that having these kinds of experiences in interesting, unique places with great people was what I wanted to do in my life as much as I possibly could. And it's hard to develop a career out of that. And my adventure career has always been peripheral. So largely the way you make a career out of that is you do these adventures and then you get paid to talk about them afterwards. And so I've been lucky enough to have, I suppose, a relatively decent portion of my annual income each year has been from speaking about these adventures. But that's never why you go into them, or shouldn't be why you go into them. You go into them because you absolutely love them. And then I'm just lucky enough to have been able to earn something out of them as well over the years. But that was never the intention. It was just wanting to have awesome adventures in hard places with great people. So it started with the cycling, and cycling is a brilliant gateway drug into adventuring because it's dead easy. Everyone's got a bicycle, or if you don't, it's very cheap to buy one. And you can have an amazing adventure on a bicycle anywhere in the UK. Or if you want to go a bit further afield, go over to Europe, and you can have a wonderful adventure with a bicycle with a couple of panniers, and just off you go. It's dirt cheap. It's nothing to it, really. It's a very accessible gateway drug. But then that gets you tempted to do more. And so after a while, I was thinking, well, what else can I do that's going to really push me? And I was looking at lots of mountaineering and climbing expeditions, and did some quite hard things there, which was great fun, big wall climbing and various bits of mountaineering. But I definitely had aspirations to do something really big. And in 2006, a friend of mine wrote to me with a link to an article about someone that had rowed across the Atlantic Ocean in a 24-foot rowboat. And he wrote to me and said, oh, Niall, we should do something like this. And it just was a light bulb moment in my head. And I was like, I've got to do that. So half an hour later, I wrote back to him saying, well, yes, we should. P.S. I've just put the deposit on a boat. So I'd fully committed within half an hour. But it wasn't a big deposit, because you can buy these flat pack boat kits that you then can make up out of plywood. And the flat pack was 300 quid or something. So it really wasn't much money for me to put down. But by that point, I was financially invested, and I'd committed me and my friend James to do this thing, which 16 months later, we ended up doing. So it was an extraordinary 16 months of training and preparation and fundraising, because to actually row the Atlantic is expensive, unlike a cycle trip or a rock climbing trip or whatever, that, which is dirt cheap. Something like an Atlantic campaign is prohibitively expensive a lot of the time. So we ended up kind of 8 years of paying that off afterwards, but worth every penny.
Wow. How much did it cost?
It's hard to be precise because I've never wanted to be completely precise about it, but probably when we did it, it would have been in the region of 50 grand or something. Whereas I know now it's more expensive just because more people are doing it. So the prices have gone up. But that was difficult. So yeah, it just meant we're in lots of personal debt for a long time. And
that's for like support craft and people giving you stuff, or
that was no. So we did join what was then a race, because there's one time of year that really you can row across the Atlantic just because of the way the winds and the currents are going. And so everyone goes at the same time, and then there's a race organized at the start of December each year. Or it used to be every 2 years, but it's each year now. But there was a support craft. We saw it once in 63 days. So it's not as if you're really being supported, because there's a fleet of 20 boats that are spread out across 1,500 miles of ocean. But by the time the race is well into its stride, the guys at the front will be literally 1,500 miles away from the guys at the back, and the support boat's got to be somewhere in the middle. So you're certainly not supported. Just the boats getting that built and fully kitted out was expensive. All of the training, like we trained 7 days a week, most weeks for most of the year. So we got super, super fit, super strong, but that just does cost a lot of money. It really does. And all of the other aspects that came with it was hugely expensive, but just an unbelievable thing to do. Because it's really hard to describe how it feels to say goodbye to land and not know when or if you're going to see it again. Like when the Canary Islands disappeared over the horizon as we went around the curvature of the earth, we didn't know whether we'd survive, genuinely. And it was a weird psychological position to be in. We hoped we would. We were planned to come back. That was absolutely our plan. But James really wasn't sure. His parents were convinced that he was committing suicide. James was very unsure whether or not we'd get through it. But putting that to one side and thinking, right, we really should get through this because we've planned that we will, we're probably not going to see land again for 2 months. And that's a weird thought. Because just you and a big hairy bloke on a 7 meter long boat for 2 months, and that's it. And it's a funny position to be in psychologically.
Yeah, it's crazy. As in, especially when you're speaking about being an extrovert earlier, and then I was going to ask, like, how do you do like these crazy things where you're so alone and isolated?
I really enjoy my own time, and I don't need to have that social interaction, I suppose, to enjoy myself. It was quite funny because I had never had an iPod or a Walkman or anything like that myself. But for this trip, one of my friends lent me one of his so that I could listen to music when I was rowing at night and stuff. And for the first 3 weeks, I hadn't realized that I had it on hold. So I just assumed it wasn't working. And then James took a look at it, and there was a little button, the hold button, which I didn't know existed. So for the first 3 weeks, I didn't have any music to listen to. I was just singing to myself. And then for the next 6 weeks, at least I had some music to listen to for the rest of the time, which made things a little bit more enjoyable.
Yeah. Crikey. And what about like food? Did that get super repetitive? Is it just all like dried stuff?
Yeah. We were consuming in the region of 7,000 calories a day, because we were doing, each of us, minimum of 12 hours of rowing a day. Each person. So our main shift was 1 hour on, 1 hour off, 24 hours a day. So when you're rowing, the other guy's resting, and then you rest, he rows. So that's 12 hours. But then we got blown off course a bit towards the end and had to do a few days of harder shifts to get ourselves back up on course, but because we've been blown too far south. And the hardest shifts we were doing there were 1 hour on, then 1 hour rowing together, and then 1 hour off while the other guy rowed. So that was 18 hours of rowing and 8 hours of rest each day. So that was only a small period, just 3 or 4 days. But that's pretty tough. So we're putting a huge amount of energy down in order to do that, and consequently you're having to put a huge amount of energy into yourself. So we're eating 7,000 odd calories a day, and that gets pretty dull. And one of the things you realize when you do long expeditions, and I've done I've done a couple of really long expeditions where you're not going to be able to resupply at any point. You can't take anything that's crisp because after time it goes soggy. So that's what you really miss. You really, really miss things that are crunchy. Something as simple as like a Pringle or just, yeah, crisp or some salty nuts or whatever it is. Something that's really, really crunchy, because it's the one thing that can't survive for very, very long time when you're away.
Wow. Yeah, all the things I've done, you kind of been able to like resupply yourself every few days and hasn't been such a problem. But it does make food really nice initially when you get to eat loads. It's become a bit tedious when you have to spend so much time eating that much. But what about the sleeping? Was that like super awkward and you only ever got like an hour gap at a time, or did you kind of get into proper polyphasic sleep?
No, it's really difficult. So the maximum you're sleeping at any one time is 48 minutes. Because when you first come in to the cabin, you switch over, brush your teeth, take clothes off, lie down, kind of count sheep, and then you're asleep, and then the alarm goes off, get yourself ready, and out you go again. So it's 48 minutes at a time. And for the first 8 days, the body was just in an absolute mess. It's like, what the hell is going on? So just seemed to knack it all the time, sleeping during the day, sleeping at night, and everything, just really all over the place. Whereas after about 8 days, body kind of just got used to it. It's like, well, this is my new thing. So during the daytime, wouldn't have to sleep so much because, yeah, your circadian rhythms are still working, and you were sufficiently attuned to that new cycle that you could stay awake. At night, it was still tough. And when it was really flat calm, it was very difficult to stay awake even while rowing. When you're being smashed by waves the whole time, you're always awake because you're terrified when the next wave's going to capsize us or whatever's going to happen. You're just awful. But then when it's really, really flat, there's basically no stimuli. And so it's so easy just to fall asleep while rowing. And it was weird to discover that when you're super fatigued, as we were at many points, different parts of your body can fall asleep at different times. So I'd be rowing, and then I'd realize something had happened. I was like, well, right, what's going on? Something's weird. I was like, my arms have stopped. And then I'd be like, okay, come on, arms, wake up. And then you shake yourself and start rowing again. Because my arms had just stopped moving. And I hadn't realized. I just figured out something wasn't right. And then other times I'd be rowing along, and then my brain would be like, okay, my face has gone to sleep. And I got this awesome photograph, because my brain was still awake, but my head was asleep. And my brain was like, okay, arms, find the camera. And my camera was just next to me always, just in case we saw something. And I grabbed my camera and I unzipped it, turned it on, and took a photograph. And the flash woke my face up, but not before I was able to photograph what I look like when I'm asleep. And it's a frightening, frightening photo. Terrible. It was really weird.
Yeah, sounds mental. That's really weird, but cool. Like, yeah, I've never had that personally.
Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary. And you find yourself hallucinating a little bit, like having funny little daydreams. I'd be dreaming that we were coming in to finish. One of the problems about really hard expeditions is you generally just want them to end the second they've started, which is a bit of a shame. Like, you really should be trying to smell the roses and enjoy what you're doing. But almost inevitably, it's sore, you're knackered, food isn't great. You just want to end it. You want it all to be over. And so we're dreaming of getting there. And I'd wake up midway through some dream while I was out meant to be rowing, and I'd be waving to some imaginary crowd. and then I'd get embarrassed at myself for waving at no one. And I was like, well, why am I embarrassed? Because I'm by myself. It's really weird what tricks your brain plays on you.
Definitely. I mean, I have stupid things like that, I guess, just when I'm working or something. And someone had been annoying me about something at the office, and I was just thinking, oh, why is this person being so stupid? And like, blah, 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 blah. And then I was like, oh, what if he's a superhero and could read people's minds? Shit, maybe he's listening to my mind right now. Oh, I really like this person. This person's great. Just doing my work. And I'm like, why the hell am I even thinking this? No one even cares, Sam. Just bloody do your work. Shut up, Sam. And I'm like, oh.
And then you're embarrassed at yourself, even though there's no one to be embarrassed to. Yeah, it's very bizarre. It's very bizarre.
Brains are weird.
They are.
But I do agree with your point about like things kind of getting easier. Certainly when I did the John O'Groats Land's End, like the first sort of week was way harder, and like, the second week was easier. So by the time you finish, you're like, oh, I can just carry on cycling. And we only did like 80 miles a day. We could do like another 50.
Before breakfast.
Yeah. It's sort of funny. You kind of think that like it just gets worse and worse, but it actually kind of gets easier and easier.
Yeah, your body gets so attuned to these things. It's amazing how tough you get after a while. And temperature-wise, I did a big expedition in the Arctic a few years ago, and I'd come straight out of a British spring where it was quite warm, and then in the Arctic, and it's also absolutely freezing. And then 25, 26 days later, I was just in my tent having some dinner, and I had my sleeping bag up to my waist. I was sitting down, and I noticed I had my sleeves rolled up. So I was wearing a t-shirt and a jumper, but my sleeves are rolled up, so my forearms are exposed. I wonder what the temperature is. And I looked at the little thermometer I had hanging inside the tent, and it was minus 11. So in 4 weeks, basically, I'd gone from finding freezing, absolutely freezing, to being overly warm at minus 11. It was just a ridiculous transition, how quickly your body can adapt to these things.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, what other expeditions have you done?
Yeah, so I skied all the way across Greenland. A great trip. So it's from the east coast to the west coast, more or less following the line of the Arctic Circle, starting a bit south of it, ending a bit north of it.
Did you have like a kite or something, or was that...
No, just, Nordic skiing, manhauling. So we started with... Our sleds were 84 kilos, and it was mainly food, equipment as well, but quite a lot of food. We had to take enough food, 5,200 calories a day, to last us for a month each. It was two of us, me and my mate Murray, did that. That was a great trip, and it gave me a bit of a buzz about Greenland in general. So I returned to Greenland 5 years after that with my brother, and we did a ski mountaineering trip where we were also speed flying, so using tiny parachute, and then skiing off the summit of the mountains we were climbing, and then flying at 50 miles an hour down back into the valley again. So that was an amazing trip. Two weeks in the middle of nowhere, just the two of us. Yeah, me and my brother, that was fantastic. Cycling in the Himalayas twice. So the one when I was 18, and then when my brother finished his A-levels, he returned to the Himalayas, and I went with him. We cycled the highest road in the world, which is up in northern India. Canoed the Yukon with the family. Yeah, multiple climbing expeditions. Been to Yosemite twice, Alps probably four or five times, those types of things. So lots of fun expeditions on that side of things. And then masses on the biological side. So just going out and doing kind of remote area research, because that always really interested me. My PhD was on an animal, that one behind me, the Baird's tapir, which lives in remote parts of Central America. And so to go and try and study them, you've got to go to some really remote places, and that was pretty exciting. Went to one place where we know we were the first outsiders ever to go. We spent 2.5 days cutting our own trail to get to this place that we wanted to survey, and then 8 days camera trapping and surveying, and then walk back out again. And on the walk in, underneath a bush, just because we were cutting our own trail, but under a bush, I found a little arrowhead flaked out of obsidian, which I obviously took home and showed to an archaeologist here, and he said, well, that's pre-Mayan, so that's over 800 years old. And it's an amazing thought that there we are, kind of, I don't know, 800, 900 years ago, there was some Mayan guy firing an arrow at someone or something, and then 800 or 900 years later, I walk past there and find this arrowhead underneath a bush. It's pretty amazing. So I got, really lucky to do a lot of remote area biological expeditions. And now... the stuff I do with National Park Rescues in a really interesting place, but we tend to have vehicular access. So we're there via Land Rover as opposed to going overland. But still, there's not many people there, which is quite nice. And when you do go out, like with the rangers and stuff, you go to some interesting parts of this big, big park where no one really goes. And that's just a pleasant thing, being in a massive, big sandstone valley, river running underneath, baboons calling all around you, echoing off the cliffs, and knowing that there's no one for miles around. It's a very nice feeling.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. So would you say like most of them you felt a bit at the time like you were complaining and then wanting it to be over, or do you think it's been a bit of a mix? Because I certainly found like most things I've done, you kind of spend the whole time being like, oh, bloody hell, I hate this thing. Oh, it's wet. Oh, my feet hurt. And then you get to the end of it, like, oh, I've had a really nice time.
Yeah. I'm similar experience to you. So my brother, Rory, middle brother, he's often reminded me before I go away on a trip, don't forget to smell the roses. Because a lot of the time you will be doing whatever it is, climbing or cycling, whatever, and you're just sore, and you're scared and you're tired and you're hungry. But just don't forget to smell the roses and think what a privilege it is to be there. Stop, don't cycle one morning or don't climb for a couple of hours, and just look around and enjoy the view. And my dad used to have a really good tactic. He would say, if you're freezing cold and really sore and soaking wet, but your toes are dry, then focus on your toes and really focus all of your positivity on those warm, dry toes, even if the rest of you's shivering and painful and freezing. But if also your toes are wet, then sing a song. And what I've found myself doing is singing a lot of songs on a lot of expeditions where everything's painful and it's sore and it's freezing and it's soaking. So you sing a song to try and distract yourself. So yeah, always taking as much opportunity as I can to smell the roses and remind yourself that you're in a really fortunate position to be here. But inevitably, you kind of want this just to be over almost all the time, which is a shame. You should be able to be in that moment a bit more.
Yeah, especially if you spend so much time preparing for the thing and then like in the thing, you're like, oh, think about other stuff. It's just a bit of a classic human condition problem. But a nice note to be ending on.
So a huge thanks for Dr. Niall McCann coming on the podcast. We had far too much to talk about and sadly missed a lot of the standard questions that I normally ask. However, I would love to promote his work further because it's just so damn important and cool. So firstly, the easiest way to find out about everything Niall does is his website, niallmccann.com. And Niall is spelled N-I-A-L-L, McCann, M-C-C-A-N-N. So niallmccann.com again. And you can have Niall come and speak at your events, you can watch the documentaries or get involved in the projects that he's up to. And his main projects are National Park Rescue. And this exists to preserve huge natural areas of land and protect the species within from poachers destroying them. At the current rate, we're 10 years away from extinction of elephants, which is just ridiculous if we don't act. And supporting people like Niall and their projects is just hugely important. Not only are you saving species, you're also reducing the funding of criminal activities such as weapons trading, human trafficking and drug smuggling, which are causing untold amounts of problems for humans as well. You're also supporting the preservation of rainforests and huge amounts of the carbon locked within them, so it's a huge benefit for the climate. His other project is Wallace Ear Trust. They educate local communities to understand the importance of the wildlife around them and empower them to look after it. So they provide jobs to indigenous populations in preserving their wildlife instead of them making money by destroying it for short-term profit. So it's really the only long-term solution. So by donating to Wallace Ear Trust, you are helping to conserve the natural world from coral reefs to orangutans, rainforests to sea turtles. It's a pretty awesome thing to help. Now, if you're thinking of doing any kind of cool project where you're raising money for charity, such as a marathon, then I would really suggest raising money for one of those great projects I've just spoken about. If you are a young, budding student or an older person considering a career change or just a career break, I would like to gently hint that you could consider helping out with these projects for a while, as I'm sure it will change your life for the better, as well as improving the world that you live in. Now, this podcast exists to just inspire people to push their boundaries and take on challenges that they didn't realise were possible. I really think Niall has highlighted how a normal human can just choose to do amazing things, and he showed the steps to actually do it. Now, I understand a lot of us are busy and some of us aren't so into doing scary things, but you can start by challenging yourself with small adventures and you can push the boundaries of your capabilities. You can progress onto a cycle adventure, such as Niall suggests, as the cheapest entry drug for doing crazy things. And it would also be amazing if you sent this podcast to one of your friends who you think would enjoy it, and perhaps they would want to do some of these sorts of things, because we all have friends who we know would be inspired by the kind of incredible journeys that Niall has done. And so if you just send them this podcast to help spread the message of how you can go and do these things and what's going on in the world, then I think you could have a real effect. And another reason is not only are you helping them to change their lives for the better, perhaps, you also benefit from the fact that by inspiring your friends to do cool things, you might do more cool things yourself, because you know the whole theory of you are the result of the five friends you spend the most time with. If you urge your mates to go and do some awesome stuff, you're much more likely to end up doing awesome stuff yourself, just because it's quite easy to tag along and do it. Yeah, so instead of trying to do difficult, scary things when you've got lots of excuses not to, if all your friends are doing it, you're much more likely to join in. So I would definitely recommend sharing this podcast with as many people as possible, and it's more likely to affect your life than if you just don't. So for own selfish reasons, share this podcast for yourself, as the logic is quite undeniable. So to wrap up, try and support Niall if you can with his awesome work. Share the podcast. If you want any help with doing these things, you're absolutely welcome to message me for any advice, and I guarantee I shall respond. And yeah, just thanks so much for listening to the podcast. You're a brilliant, fantastic, lovely human being, and super appreciated that you listened to my work. And I hope whatever else you go on to listen to today inspires you only furthermore. Goodbye. You've just listened to an episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your preferred app and give me a good rating, as these go a really long way. If you are unable to give good feedback right now, try sharing the show with a friend who will, or just wait for the show to improve. If you have any ideas for the show or you just want to chat, then please reach out to me on Twitter at SamHarrisTweets or Instagram at SamJamSnaps. Show notes and other links to topics discussed in the episodes are available at the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com. Thanks so much for listening. Give yourself a big hug from me. If you're with a friend, give them a hug as well. And I hope you enjoy your next podcast.